Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Gaming News Canada show. As always, I'm your host, Steve McAllister. The National Basketball Association last week announced that Jontay Porter of the Toronto Raptors has been banned from the league. A league investigation revealed the 24-year-old Porter violated league rules by disclosing confidential information to sports bettors, limiting his own participation to one or more games for betting purposes, and betting on NBA games. The league's investigation remains open and may result in further findings. The league also mentioned in a statement last week that it has shared and will continue to share information with federal prosecutors about this matter. The bans announced at the same time that Major League Baseball is also dealing with its own gambling scandal with LA Dodgers superstar Shohei Ohtani in the middle of that. That's also sparked further debate around the ties between professional sports leagues and sports wagering in the still new regulated gambling landscape here in Canada and across the U.S. Daniel Lemfleet, the founder and CEO of Kindbridge Behavioral Health, will join us later in the podcast. But to get things rolling, I'm extremely pleased to welcome a couple of esteemed members of the Fourth Estate. One who's covered the Toronto Raptors since their inception way, way back in 1995, and the other, a former NBA beat writer who these days covers the business of sports betting and gaming. We welcome to the Gaming News Canada Show podcast from the Toronto Star, Doug Smith, and from Legal Sports, Mike Mazzeo. Smitty, thanks so much for joining us, and this is a bit of a reunion for you and I. It's
been a long time. We go back a long time, Steve, a long, long time.
And Mike, it's great. You and I, we've been able to cross paths the last, the last 3 years now at various conferences in the U.S. And like me, you're a guy who was a longtime sports journalist who's kind of made that transition into covering the sports betting and gambling industry.
Yeah, Steve, thanks a lot for having me. It's been great knowing you. And, it's wild that it's been a few years for me. I thought I was going to be a sports writer my whole life. Things didn't exactly work out the way I planned, but I'm really thankful. This industry has been really fun to cover, really captivating, and thankful I get to do this every day.
Yeah, and you and Smitty know each other from a little ways back.
Back in old Brooklyn Nets, Toronto Raptors series, long time ago.
And the Nets were bad enough where I got to cover the Raptors. So I was like an honorary Canadian citizen up there. I was spending, exactly. It turned out to be a long time because they made the conference finals the year I covered the team. So yeah. It turned out to be a couple weeks. It was like 6 weeks.
We can always use more good people up here, Mike, believe me. Hey, Smitty, I want to start with you. And again, as I mentioned before we hit the record button on this podcast, and this podcast deals a lot with, or mainly we focus on sports betting and gambling industries, especially in the regulated industry. But maybe you can just tell the audience to start with who Jontay Porter is and how big a story this has been. And to be honest, when I followed the Raptors coverage this season and follow you on Twitter, most of the conversation has been around a pretty, pretty stinko season for the Raptors. But where the Porter investigation just kind of the tip of the iceberg, or just one chapter in a real difficult season?
It was the weirdest of a very weird season, probably. Basically, Jontay Porter was a nobody. He's a guy who they picked up on a 2-way contract in December, mostly when they didn't have any bodies. He's a 7-footer that needed a tall player. He had some intriguing abilities, but he wasn't a guy that anybody would have recognized or cared an awful lot about. And I think in a lot of ways it was the perfect storm for a situation like this. Relatively low paid player. No one would fly under everybody's radar. And if you look at a circumstance, this is the kind of guy I think would be right for this kind of scandal.
Mike, did this story, because it involved an NBA player, did it fall on your radar a little bit sooner, or how has Legal Sports Report followed this story?
Yeah, I mean, when ESPN reported it, obviously it was eye-opening that NBA was kind of the only the four North American major sports to not really have anything, and all of a sudden they really had the first player that was banned for life, I think, in the legal era. Forgive me if that's an incorrect fact, but yeah, we just hopped on it right away, and it kind of took on a life of its own. The way that Adam Silver talked, to call it a cardinal sin and say he could ban this guy for life. I mean, a lot of these sports will say when somebody gets in a probe, we're actively investigating, we don't have any further comment. For Adam to come out as strongly as he did indicated he had stuff on this guy. And so then it came out that he had the FanDuel account, the VIP account in Colorado, but didn't make any NBA bets. But of course, I talked to sources who said, just because he didn't have any NBA bets in Colorado doesn't mean the NBA is not finished for him. They're actively investigating this. And I think it was the next day it came out that he was banned for life, and he violated every possible thing you could do. Yeah. He gave insider information. He threw basically his own performance to manipulate that bet. And it was just awful. And here's a guy who knew how this industry worked and knew people in it, was connected in it, given his FanDuel account that, you know, they closed when he signed with the NBA. Like you guys said, he's a two-way player fighting for his spot, not making that much money. But the wild thing is his brother is so successful and going to make hundreds of millions of dollars. Yeah, yeah. He didn't need this. And yet now you look at it long-term, and Steve, I'm sure you're going to ask us about this. Like, you can't probably have prop bets offered on two-way players and lower paid players, right? Like Doug said, it was the perfect storm. Let's cut this off. You can bet on the superstars, LeBron, Steph Curry, Jokic, you know, Luka, whoever, but you can't have these guys. It just you can't have it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big issue that I saw a takeaway from the NBA is these prop bets and parlay bets on younger on basically players that are making no money. That's who you get. That's who's going to get involved in this. The superstars, the LeBrons, the Currys, the they're inured of this. This is never going to touch them. It's certainly not. The money is it's not worth it. It's not worth the gamble. It's not worth it's not worth the risk, because what they're risking is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, and you cannot get that in prop bets. But I don't know, Mike. That's an interesting point about taking prop bets and parlay bets off younger players. How you could draw that line. I think you should, but I don't know how you can do that if you do it below minimum salary. But then how you get the betting sites to police that? I guess that's. It's an interesting thing that they have to do, but I don't know how they can do it.
Hey, Mike, to that point, it just seems that, you know, if you talk, there's almost two different storylines here. That people will point at this suspension and say, this is why you have to have a regulated industry, because as soon as Porter, this stuff started happening, it was flagged by the integrity monitoring service that the league employs. And it was pretty easy to follow the breadcrumbs here. And then you'll have the other faction who will say, this is what happens when you have sports betting advertising on TV all the time. And it's so easy to place a bet on your phone now. And this was a shit show waiting to happen. But it does seem here there might be an appetite by both the operators and the league and the NBA, just because there does tend to be more transparency and Adam Silver tends to, you know, be a lot more competent at his job than Gary Bettman and Rob Manfred and Roger Goodell are. That this is an issue, this prop betting issue, that the league will deal with quickly, and they'll have support from the operators.
Yeah, I think that's probably, you know, like with the college prop betting, right, in the U.S. with the NCAA, it seems like that's going to be banned nationwide. A lot of states already did it. Now you have the NCAA president coming out and saying it needs to be banned everywhere, and a lot of jurisdictions have followed that. Steve, I think the question is, with the nuance of the situation, like you said, there's two sides, right? There's our kind of industry bubble, and then there's people that hate gambling, is really why the leagues decided to take this sportsbook partnership money in the first place, right? I think they projected $167 million to be split among the owners and the players this year from gambling-related partnerships. The players can have this 1% kind of non-passive income in these fantasy and gambling companies. So the Players Association was involved, but, you know, at the same time, I mean, the NBA is not the only league to do it, but all these teams took the money and now everyone says these games are rigged and you're never going to get that back. And so, like you said, the question is, you know, what kind of safeguards can you put in to protect not only the league's integrity, but then the players, the team masseuse, the low PR people, you know, the people on the totem pole, not calling anyone out specifically, but just people that could have that nefarious information. You know, I mean, even with Adam Silver being a great commissioner, sure, but there's been so many teams that have been fined for improper injury reporting. I mean, how is that even possible? And these $25,000 fines, $100,000 fines haven't done anything to curtail it. So do you need harsher penalties? Do you need a third party to, you know, make sure if the Raptors or Nets or Knicks or whatever team it is puts out injuries, they're correct, because people are betting on this and the lines are moving because of these injuries. It needs to be as fair to every gambler as possible. Everyone should have that information, especially if the leagues are going to take this sportsbook partnership money, which they have.
Yeah, obviously, like the money is, they're not going to give the money back. I mean, the genie's not going back in the bottle. This is here now. and the best way to find how to regulate it or penalize misconduct. Like the injury report is a very interesting thing. The league, the NBA, you have to put your injury report out every hour, and things are, you know, questionable in. Well, something in an hour happened that maybe the line, maybe paid up. If you make a bet on questionable and 2.5 later is in, you're doing everybody a disservice. I don't know. Maybe it might have to be a third party, because obviously the teams, the franchises don't care. They write their check and they go on, and their business goes on without anything bothering them. So the fines, I don't think, is an issue, but maybe repeated offenders get penalized strictly, lose a draft pick, lose something like that. I don't know. But though that's in the NBA, because there are so many frequent games, the frequency of games and the frequency of injury reports, that's the one I think is the next issue that really has to get addressed.
And I think, Mike, you and I think it was you and I joking a little bit on Twitter this week about the NHL and its lower body, upper body injuries, which has driven me nuts for more than a decade. And in fact, when I was managing the sports department at Yahoo Canada about 15 years ago, I said to Greg Wyshynski and Nick Kotsenika, our Puck Daddy blogger and our NHL columnist at one point, I said, I'm almost at the point where I want to institute a policy where we don't refer to we start guessing on what injuries are if the NHL is going to continue playing this game, because it's so bloody silly.
It was that Jack Hughes injury late in the season. You know, is he going to be out for the year? Is he not? You know, that's the NHL culture, right? The hockey culture in Canada is one of the most scrutinized things right now for very understandable reasons. But yeah, I agree with you. The lower body injury thing, the upper body injury thing is ridiculous. And the fact, even with the Shane Pinto suspension, 41 games, we still don't know what he did. And I know the Players Association, the NHL, negotiated some sort of settlement where it doesn't come out. But I can't imagine, again, because the NHL takes the same money and the ads are everywhere. The marketing is everywhere. The advertising is everywhere. I can't believe they don't have to come out and say. I think they owe it to the public to say what he did. And especially even to prevent it from happening again. I mean, it seemed like the journalists were asking players in the league what happened. And the players on other teams didn't even know. Or at least they weren't going to divulge it. So, yeah, that's just unacceptable to me in this day and age.
I would absolutely think that the NBA is the leader in this, because they are very, very transparent about this. And for Adam Silver to come out with the actual dollar number amounts that Porter bet, that's very significant to me, that they take this very lightly, don't take this very lightly. And they want everything out there so that the public can understand what they base their decision on. The hockey one I can't speak to, except that I was shocked, but that they would do this and not tell anybody why. That makes absolutely no sense at all. And it causes everything to be under even more scrutiny, because you're screwing people around. And why do you believe them the next time if they won't tell you the first time?
It was also a missed opportunity too, guys, just to educate people. And that's one of the things we hear right now, is that, you know, athletes, or to Mike's point, the staff, team staff or league staff, don't know what the league's policy is, or don't understand what we can and can't do. And if the NHL had been transparent about this, when you read the NBA statement, Smitty, I mean, it's like Mike said, it details every single transgression that Porter made. And if you're an NBA player, all you have to do is read that statement, and you have a pretty damn good idea now of what you can and can't do when it comes to sports wagering, right?
Yeah, and their families know it. The players' families know it too. We talked when ESPN report first came out. We talked to a bunch of Raptors, I did, and they, to a man, told me, we don't talk to anybody about anything. Who's playing? Who's not playing? Who might play? Who might play tomorrow? Who won't play next week? We can't do it, so we don't do it, and we don't allow them to even ask us that question. Garrett Temple, who is the vice president of the Players Association, is on the Raptors, and he said, look, we are read the rules every month. They're almost reminded of this. So they know, and they know the penalty, and they know what they can and can't do. And they tell their friends and families, don't ask us, because I can't tell you. And I'm not going to tell you. If you continue to pester me, you're done. I can't risk, players can't risk their lives, their careers, on a slip of the mouth.
Hey guys, I just want to quickly read the NBA policy, because again, the pro sport leagues have different policies. Smitty, you'll remember this, and Mike, you might too. I mean, when Doug, you and I were covering Major League Baseball for the Canadian Press back in the 90s, the first thing you saw when you walked into a clubhouse was a sign that said you can't bet on baseball. So the NBA policy is, quote, players, teams, and league employees cannot bet on NBA games or any of its properties. This includes not only NBA games, but also related leagues such as the WNBA, G League, and Summer League. The exception, if sports betting is legal in their area, players and employees are allowed to bet on other sports outside the NBA. That's pretty black and white, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, I think kind of goes back to the NFL to go to another sport. Like, they had 10 guys suspended for all of 2023 for violations dating back to 2022. And I think some said we knew and we did it anyway. And some said, yeah, we didn't understand the rules. So I think at this point, I mean, every league is going in, whether it's spring training or, you know, in the preseason or training camp, and telling these guys, don't do this. You know, here's the ramification. Here's the penalties if you do it. And that has to continue, because there is always going to be one player or two. You know, if you tell 500 guys something, the majority of them probably will follow the rules, but then there's always going to be one that thinks they're above the law, or, you know, is ignorant and doesn't understand. And so you have to keep drilling it. You just can't do it enough.
It's amazing to me how far it's gone with the NBA. Steve, you remember, the NBA insisted that the province of Ontario take NBA gambling off their pro-line lottery until they were to give their Toronto franchise. That was in 1995. That's not all that long ago that they were in the David Stern era. They were absolutely dead against any kind of betting. And these were like goofy little pro-line three-team parlays. And they insisted that the NBA games be taken off the government lottery, or else it wasn't to give the team to the franchise in Toronto. And today, you can't spit in an arena without seeing a FanDuel ad, or in a locker room, or anywhere. I mean, it's everywhere, and that's a whole different thing to me. But it's amazing how we got to where we are so quickly.
Hey, Doug, I mean, Mike and I, we're kind of out, you know, we're, Mike, you and I are no longer considered mainstream sports media. I mean, we're covering a different industry now. And Smitty, I'm not in the press boxes anymore or sitting courtside. But what's the scuttlebutt about amongst guys like yourself and Bruce Arthur, your colleague at the Toronto Star, and Michael Grange from Sportsnet, and all the people out there, Kayla Gray, covering basketball? Like, have there you guys had a lot of conversations about sports betting and kind of this brave new world?
We really haven't, because I'm of a certain age that I don't report point line or point spreads or betting lines. It's not part of my job. It's not part of the information I provide my readers. I don't feel that's necessary. So we really don't discuss them that much. I don't talk, way back in the day, I might have placed a bet every now and then, but you had to go to a bar and meet Bobby on a Saturday afternoon. But now we don't. I don't even look. I don't have an app on my phone. We don't talk about it in the locker room or in the press room before the game. But we know it's everywhere. But I don't know that the readers I serve, I don't feel a need to give them that information.
And I, Mike, I wrote in the newsletter a couple of months ago. I interviewed Neil Campbell, who Doug will know from Neil's days covering baseball, and Neil was my predecessor of sports at the Globe and Mail. And Neil was a longtime horse racing writer and said, you know, there was a day where if you were covering horse racing for the Washington Post and New York Times, it was assumed that you didn't, you know, you couldn't bet on horse racing. And to me, it's kind of a no-brainer in a profession where ethics and integrity, if you're not ethical and you don't have your integrity, you're in the wrong job. I can't imagine Doug ever placing a bet on a Raptors game he's around the team every day. And so it would seem to me, Mike, that that would be a given.
Yeah, I agree. Right. And that's what, going back to Toronto again, that was the Shohei Ohtani, you know, is he on the plane at Toronto? People reporting he is, that moving the odds. It was a journalism disaster.
Right.
And, you know, ESPN has a list of things its reporters can't do, but it's inevitable, right? Sham Sharani is a partner of FanDuel. Yeah. He didn't really touch these things. You know, he put out the press release that Porter was suspended, but I don't think he tweeted about the suspension when Woj broke the story. I know those guys kind of have their beef or whatever it is, but you would just imagine it's the biggest story in your sport. If you're a national reporter, you need to be reporting on this. So there's a lot of issues here. And it wouldn't be surprising, right? We always talk about a match fixing scandal. It wouldn't be surprised if there's some sort of journalism scandal where, you know, with the shams and the odds of the draft picks, right? I mean, I'm amazed sportsbooks even offer that stuff. That's a recipe for inside information and disaster there, integrity violations. So, yeah, you know, I mean, we're just in the early innings of this, and that's something Doug can speak to this. It's something that will have to be addressed and will always have to be addressed.
Yeah, it's really, Mike, you're right. It's very, very gray because journalists do impact lines by what they report and tweet and say. And, it, you know, if we get information from trainers, back of house guys, do we put that information out there? Knowing might change. It might impact on how much money a person bets on a game. And there are so many different layers of it and gray of it that you're right. There are going to be scandals happen at levels that we don't think about. And then it's going to be, oh, now what do we do? How do we do this? And I guess it's just a new era, I suppose. But frankly, I'm glad I'm closer to the end than I am beginning.
And the toughest part, just the toughest part with the Jontay Porter thing too, is he bet against the Raptors. I mean, that's the other, you know, that's the cardinal sin, right? That is really the thing. And then you hope it doesn't get to the point of a huge match fixing scandal where multiple guys are involved. That's going to be the tip of the iceberg that the legal industry can't afford and the sports leagues can't afford. And you hope it doesn't go there, but it wouldn't be surprising given what's happened if it does.
It wouldn't, Mike. I think the NCAA's move, I think that's absolutely necessary because those are the guys who could take the money and be set up their lives and not have no compunction to do it. I think that's the area where you need to be focused at because those kids can be bought. The LeBrons and the Steppers can. Young guys can. And I think getting them out of the mix protects them, protects the bettors, and protects the betting industry. Because, like, you're right, the industry can't afford a big global scandal because a lot of these sites I don't presume are operating on great margins and some of them might just disappear.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, Mike, if you talk to, you know, with what's going on with the banning of US college prop betting, you get some people have said, well, okay, well, this is going to push bettors back to the illegal operators. But then I've also read, you know, that U.S. college prop betting accounts are like 0.05% of all handles. So again, it just seems to be an easy decision if you want to try to make sure there's as much integrity as possible in the games that and just on appearances alone, it might be a good idea to kind of support a ban on prop betting with U.S. college games. Just as Smitty said a few minutes ago, it probably makes sense to put some guardrails in place that. Yeah, find a bet on LeBron James or Steph Curry and have prop bets around him, but let's not have prop bets on the guy who's only going to play 6 or 7 minutes a night.
And I think you'll just get easy buy-in from the – sorry, Doug, I didn't mean to cut you off. You're just going to get easy buy-in from the sports books, I think. They're just going to say, no problem, you know. It was good, like to the legal industry's point. DraftKings has that data they put out, right? And usually it's LeBron or Steph or somebody will be the top bet player, but – the ones with Jontay Porter in January and March, that was a huge red flag. Wow, eye-opening. Why is this going on? I can't believe somebody's placing an $80,000 parlay on all these unders, it hitting, and then, you know, his associate and him not think, hey, this is going to get flagged. You usually don't play and you don't have any stats, and this guy just won $1.1 million on you. That's going to cause some problems, and it did.
Yep. There wasn't a lot of brightness. There wasn't a lot of wisdom going on this whole thing and this whole process, but yeah, that's a thing. It's the young guys, the kids, and again, I guess in my opinion, the system worked, and I'm glad it did because I don't think the regular great unwashed of fans even know these investigations or these companies exist to track these kind of things, and that they did and that they found it and exposed it. And dealt with it really, really quickly. This was February. This was done in early April. So I think the system worked. And I think that's probably a good thing to take away from this, in the NBA at least.
A word from our sponsor. Hey there, sports fans. Are you looking for fresh and fun takes on the hottest topics in Canadian sports? Well, we've got just what you need. Introducing Homestand Sports Today, your go-to daily sports newsletter, bringing you the Canadian angle on the hottest NHL, NBA, footy stories, and more right to your inbox. But wait, there's more. Homestand Sports isn't just another text-heavy newsletter. Every story has its own video featuring our talented hosts like me, Albert Vartanian, giving you a newsletter experience like never before. And did I mention it's a free subscription? Subscribe now at homestand.ca.
Now back to the show.
Hey, Doc, just to the point that Mike made about match fixing and scandals, and again, we saw, you know, like, what's Tim Donaghy now? Is that 20 years ago? And it's not like, you know, you, the three of us were, we weren't even thought of yet when the Black Sox scandal happened back in the early 1900s. But, you know, Declan Hill, who's done a lot of coverage around match fixing and teaches a course at, I think, the University of New Haven now, has been beating the drum about that, sport is just ripe for a scandal given this new environment. Would you agree with that, Doug? Or do you think that even though there is easier access to sports betting now, it seems that there are so many guardrails in place that if we're going to have more Jonte Porters, you're just going to have more suspensions and bans?
I think it would be very, very hard by the sheer number of people necessary involved in it to fix an NBA game. And I know that maybe you could fix an over-under and prop bets. Obviously you can, but you can just take a lot of shots and miss them. But to impact the results of a game, I don't know that that's – I don't agree that they're ripe for this to happen. Could it? I suppose. Anything could, I suppose. But I don't think – I'm not sure that's – I think the scandal is going to be individuals as opposed to games.
Mike?
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense because of the prop bets, right? You could tell everybody, hey, I'm just going to take a three and miss or whatever it would be, like those specific, you know, in-game player props, especially early in a game. You know, you could potentially fix those for a specific result. So, yeah, and it only takes one guy. I think that is the scary part, to Doug's point. Like, it only takes one person now where, yeah, maybe I can't get 5-10 guys, but I could do it myself if I'm that lower paid player. And that's why, you know, whether Doug said, well, what's the cutoff for who gets, you know, banned from, prohibited from being offered is a great question that the NBA and other leagues are going to have to figure out. But they have to stop it because you want to try to cut this off as much as you can, and that at least will help potentially prevent it.
I do think the one that really I'm concerned about most, I think, are these in-game parlays, because you could go to halftime and check your phone in the locker room and find, okay, here's the number in the third quarter. Go do this or don't do this. I think those are going to be looked at very closely in the future, because you could not screw the game, but you can certainly make or lose a lot of money for a lot of people in a very short amount of time.
Hey, Doug, covering the league now, is there eye rolling in press row about the number of, you know, seeing the FanDuel and PointsBet ads in the arena and hearing about the commercials and
My eyes roll every day. They're everywhere. They're too much, in my opinion. And I think what bothers me is that, and I don't want to, because I'm a newspaper, I'm going to come on this. On the broadcast, they're too much. They're treated as part of the journalistic process, and they're not. And I think that's the thing that bothers me the most, is that any highlight show, any sports center show you watch, they have segments bet on in-game parlays or their own parlays, their own pregame show. But here's our parlay for the game. I think they're too much. I think they're a slippery road. And I don't think they're, if you want to be a journalist, I don't think they should be part of what you do. I honestly don't.
And Mike, I think part of the issue with, some of the backlash to regulated sports betting, I think, has been because the integration of sports betting and sports media has been so clumsy in a lot of examples. And I think, to Doug's point, what happened where there was such outrage in Ontario was Hockey Night in Canada and Sportsnet doing such a lousy job of integrating that betting content at the beginning. And just, I think people just felt they were being hit over the head with a coho with sports betting advertising. And Have you seen the same thing in south of the border?
Yeah, I mean, New York went live, I think, what, January 2022? I think I watched a Knicks game and just wrote a story purely on how many times sports betting logo was up there, and I think it was 25 in 2 hours or something like that. Now, at the Super Bowl, there was one pregame ad and two during the game. I think, okay, you know, whether you want to do a whistle-to-whistle ban, and Canada, I think, is ahead of us in terms of those kind of restrictions, I'd be completely fine with that. I think the industry at this point would as well. They have to, you know, give a little bit. If they want to take, they have to give a little bit. And I think they're good about that. And like Doug said, right, this regulated industry, DraftKings, I think, he bet at DraftKings that $80,000 parlay, they flagged it with U.S. Integrity, the integrity monitor. So like you guys said, the system worked. All these other things that come with it, you know, there are concerns. And not everybody bets on sports. It's a small segment. We're in our own bubble a lot of times and just kind of blowing this stuff off. I think a lot the industry does, but there's greater people out there that do not care about gambling. They have to be taken into account too. So yeah, a lot of questions here still.
Mike, I think I hadn't heard very often about a whistle-to-whistle ban. I think that would save – that would, a lot of fans would love that, because there are a lot of people who watch games who don't bet and don't care and don't know and don't understand it. Not have to be inundated with it from the puck drop to the whistle, or from the jump tip to the buzzer. I think you're doing your fans and your viewers a pretty good service, because the people who bet have bet and they know. And they know how to do it if they want to do it during the game. The people who don't do it and don't want to do it don't want to see it. That might be a pretty good solution to me.
Yeah, we have seen that happen in some countries, Smitty. I think Australia recently has put in a whistle-to-whistle ban on advertising around soccer games, probably cricket. I'm thinking cricket and rugby matches there. And I think, Matt, also there's some European countries that have that whistle-to-whistle ban as well.
I think, good idea. I just think, you know, with the whistle-to-whistle, right, like, can you opt in? You know, is there something where you can opt in, right? We're wondering when single screen is going to come. Latency is always a problem with in-game betting. But, you know, opt in if you want this stuff. Have a separate Raptors broadcast or whatever, Nets, Knicks, whatever it is, where they talk about betting the entire time, over-unders, like they're calling a game, and then you have your regular broadcast and a whistle-to-whistle ban where people don't have to see it. If they're sports fans, they just want to watch the game, watch the game. If you want to bet on the game, here's a specific for you. Might cost the companies a little more money, but would be a solution where you could get it if you want and you don't have to have it if you don't.
Like a Manning cast for gamblers. That's pretty good.
And there are some of that.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And I think that's the format that makes the most sense, guys, where if you want some gambling information, and, you know, we have, I think, Smitty, 5 TSN stations now. If you're still an old time cable subscriber like I am, and you probably are too. And yep. Sportsnet, I think there's 6 different Sportsnet networks. So not to mention, you know, YouTube channels and streaming and everything else. So I think that's where that process has to go. Hey, Smitty, last question for you. Just, you know, the whole notion, I mean, it's not, as you mentioned earlier, I mean, sports writers have been betting forever. I mean, I remember covering spring training as a still fairly young reporter back in the early 90s and going to the dog races with Neil A. and Dave Perkins and Ken Fidlin from the Toronto Sun, and an evening out, and it was fun, and I was there one night and ran into, like, I think the entire St. Louis Cardinals coaching staff with Joe Torre and I think Joel Coleman, the pitching staff, and a bunch of people, and you always have a little, you know, we've had, you do the no hitter pools in the press box during a Blue Jays game. Is it a different environment now? Like, again, I'm assuming not, but do you see reporters on their phones or guys talking to you about putting a bet on their Bet365 or Sports Interaction accounts?
No, I mean, I'm not certainly naive enough to think it doesn't happen. And I'm sure many of my colleagues have their own accounts and make their bets every day. But it's not discussed out anymore. And it's not like talked about like back in the day where, hey, we're going to the track tonight, or hey, we're going to the dogs, or hey, who do you like? Do you like the Bills +7 on Sunday? Those conversations don't exist anymore. The dynamic of the press, of the media, is different. It's far younger than me now, and they have their own little lives and their own ways to do what they got to do. But guys at my level, at my age, we don't talk about that anymore, because it's just not out there anymore. I don't bet anymore. I used to, you know, back, I was a pretty big football guy. but I don't do anymore because I, one, I can't afford to lose anymore, and two, I kind of lose the interest in it. But I'm not certainly, as I said, naive enough to think that 10 of my guys who I'm working with in the press room all have action on something that night somehow. Just that's just numbers.
Yeah. Hey, Mike, last one for you. I just wondered, you talk to some of your former colleagues in the sports journalism business, and are they giving you a hard time about covering sports betting? And are they asking you questions about what goes on the regulated industry? Like, what are those conversations like?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny that, like, when I covered the NBA, which was, like, I think almost 10 years, like, I didn't hear, because it was before the pandemic, I don't think I heard one person ever talking about this stuff on press row, in the stands. Then you go to a Knicks game these days, everybody's got action on something. And that's, like, the interesting part about sports fandom. Like, are you rooting for the Raptors? Yeah. Are you rooting for your bets? Are you rooting for your fantasy team? Like, who are you rooting for? In 20 years, that's going to be fascinating. So, yes, I think a lot of my friends have been really good. I think they kind of know me as the gambling guy, right? Like, I had one act as the Nets guy, then one act as the Yankees guy. Now I'm like the gambling guy. Not for like props or tout. I'm not touting or anything, giving up picks.
It'd be a good parlay right there. It could have been a good parlay. It could be a lot of money at that, maybe.
A lot of my friends in the industry, will ask questions. You know, I have people ask me about regulation, and that's fine. I'm happy to be a resource for everybody. You know, I don't cover that day to day. I don't care who wins. You know, I care about the regulatory aspect, the legislative aspect of what bills are coming down. So I kind of enjoy what I do. It's very niche. It's definitely in our own bubble at times, but I appreciate that I have friends that still cover it and would be fine if sports betting went away and don't care about it at all. Like, that's a perfect balance to have.
Mike Maseo is the gambling industry beat writer for Legal Sports Report and a really good one. Doug Smith is the Toronto Raptors beat writer for the Toronto Star. Hey, guys, I'm really glad we could get two of you together. And Smitty, it's been too long since you and I have had a chance to chat. And, you know, we, on a personal note, we have so many great memories from that time together working at the Canadian Press, I think, for five years back in the late 80s, early 90s. And Mike, you're one of my favorite people to bump into at the gambling conferences. And as I think, Mike, I've said to you too, I mean, I think one of the things about working in this industry, it's no different than sports journalism. It's a really good, there's a good group of people. It's a professional group just trying to do good work. And guys like you and I think have been really fortunate to kind of work in those two environments where we both had a chance to work with guys like Doug for a long time. And we're in an industry now where we're also working alongside some great journalists and good people.
Goes to what players say. You never remember the game, you remember the players. You remember the teammates. And that's what we do too.
Yep, and never forget, Smitty, you and I staying in a hotel room in Atlanta after the 92 World Series, after enjoying Ted Turner and Jane Fonda's hospitality the night before, trying to crank out a couple of stories before we flew home to Toronto on Monday morning. But maybe one of the longest days of our career.
We got it done, though, because we're pros.
Listen, thanks again, guys, for doing this, and hopefully our paths cross in person at some point.
That's a free take. Hey, Mike, take care of yourself, man.
We welcome now to the podcast the founder and CEO of Kindbridge Behavioral Health, Daniel Umfleet, who joins us from Southampton, England. Daniel, really appreciate you joining the Gaming News Canada show, especially given the fact that you're playing a little bit hurt right now.
I appreciate the opportunity, Steve. And, you know, we just play through, buddy. We just play through.
Yeah, exactly. I feel your pain. Hey, Daniel, I want to start just on your own story in the gambling industry and your involvement around the player health issue. And you were the chief operating officer at Gambin, a UK problem gambling support company, I think until 2020 when you created Kindbridge. And, you know, an interesting company now. I mean, you're clients kind of run across the sports and sports betting industry, announced a partnership last month with DraftKings and Sport Radar, NASCAR, US Integrity, BetMGM, Entain, the NFL Players Association's Professional Athletes Foundation. So this your company has a fingers in a lot of pies here. I mean, what's been the motivation for you to go down this path?
Population health and public health have always been sort of passions of mine. So my career before all of this was healthcare consulting. And one of the things that I like to do the most was solve big system issues for large healthcare systems. And when I got involved with Gamban, it was a peek inside of a population that I'd never heard of or seen before, which was disordered gamblers. And the deeper that I started to dig, the more the healthcare side of the equation started to bug me. So I started really thinking about how healthcare strategy can be used on this population to get them access to the right kind of resources faster, and then provide a lot of clarity around what goes on with the population once they reach out to start their recovery journey. And in 2020, when COVID hit, the opportunity really presented itself because everything needed to be migrated onto telehealth. And the United States is extremely large, and it's very complicated to do multi-state population health strategies on small budgets. And telehealth helped make all of that possible. And so we basically spun up a virtual clinic that is underpinned by some pretty good technology that helps us get some insights on clientele that come in to see us for treatment. And we just kind of keep growing, and it keeps getting bigger, which makes it more interesting, and is also why I'm moving to Denver, Colorado in July and getting off of this rock that is the United Kingdom.
Before I forget too, I do want to mention the work that Kindbridge does with U.S. veterans too, because as we all know, the military, whether here in Canada or the U.S. and other parts of the world, there are a lot of retired military people, current military people dealing with their old mental health challenges right now. And I assume that's probably been a fairly significant part of your business as well.
It's been one of the most interesting parts of the business, to be honest. Niche populations or subpopulations, getting to know the population and then getting to understand how they respond and how they want to interact with different treatment modalities and what is appealing to them to help get them started on that pathway is probably the most interesting part of my job, to be honest. And in Colorado specifically, the military veterans program in Colorado has been very successful, and we're happy to continue that work throughout the rest of this year and into next. And hopefully that just keeps going and going and going. It's been really, really well received, and it's been a big success for us.
We did want to get you on the podcast, Daniel, to talk about the Jonte Porter ban by the NBA last week. You know, there's been so much coverage, and when you look at Porter, some people will say, well, why would a guy, you know, making pretty good money? And again, Porter certainly isn't making the same type of money as LeBron James or Steph Curry, but I think has made around $3 million in his young NBA career so far. And so you get a group of people saying, why would a guy risk his career and making millions of dollars to do this? And then you read the other side where athletes and just the way that they're built, the problem gambling is a path that those players can go down. Are there any particular red flags that kind of were brightest with you or really came on your radar as you follow this Porter situation?
There are a couple of things that immediately sort of sprung to mind. He's got a lot of life going on right now outside of what was going on with his own personal situation. I think the fact that his young brother was just sentenced to 6 years in prison for a DUI, where the result was an unfortunate death. And then also he's got a bigger brother who's playing on a team that is significantly performing at a higher level, I think is a very polite way of putting it, right? I think when I think about a lot of the work that we do with athletes, there's a lot of things that are really influencing their behaviors in the here and now. And a lot of times it's traumatic stress from other situations, either in their past or that they're currently going through, which make them kind of a little bit blind to some of the risks that are right in front of them. And then also, you know, I kind of got the sense in digging around and following what was going on with this is, you know, this guy, Jonte Porter has been, I mean, he's a hustler, right? Like he has worked his butt off in several different locations around the globe in order to continuously play basketball. He's fought through injuries, and he's just sort of made his way back to the game, right? And I think what's interesting about that is here's a guy who can come in and play, but at the same time, he's not really been in a situation where he's been a building block, so to speak, for the success of a team. So he performs, but he doesn't perform at the level of competition that some of, you know, the other majors around the league perform at, right? So he's a good guy, but he's not somebody to build a team around, so to speak. And I think in some instances, when you've got a history of sort of being in and out of the game, and then more or less like maybe this isn't going to be a really, really long career for me, some potential, let's call it side gigs, may kind of creep their way into your thought process, and you might start thinking and planning for something else. And this is honestly, like, I've not met the guy. I've not spoken with him. I have no idea if this is a situation. So I just want to be clear there. But those are two things that stuck out to me, having previously worked with a handful of athletes from professional environments. And when you kind of dig in and get a level of understanding on what's really driving the behavior, those are things that are not uncommon. Not to bring this into the college athlete spectrum, but one of the things you see with the college athletes now with the NIL in place is you see some that realize, you know, they're not collecting the NIL dollars that some of their teammates or some of the other folks in their conference are collecting. And so decisions tend to get made based off of believing whether or not they're going to be in the draft and going to the next level. And oftentimes when we find these things kind of getting brought into the light, a lot of that decision-making process is led by not getting as much as the next guy, if that makes sense, right? So it could be any of those factors, all of those factors, none of those factors. And until we kind of hear more, it's tough to tell. But just at a top level, when you look at what's going on in his life, he's got a lot of life going on around him that I think was probably creating a lot of stress points for him.
Yeah, I wonder if people forget too, Daniel, that these, professional athletes, there's a lot of idle time. I mean, it's a fairly short work day. You go to practice for a couple of hours. You might do some weight training. You might watch some video. But I think most professional sport teams, you're kind of in and out probably within a 5-hour time frame every day, or on a game day. Again, you're kind of sitting around, you know, waiting for that 7:30 tip off. And if you're a 24-year-old, very, very still young man in a city where you don't know anybody, and maybe Porter situation, probably didn't have any friends yet that were teammates. There's a lot of hours where you're isolated, right?
100%. And that's a really good point, right? And we see that a lot with military personnel as well, as they get deployed overseas. The loneliness and isolation in that transition period of kind of blending into your surroundings and getting comfortable with where you are, for a lot of people, transition periods are the most vulnerable times, right? And so having all of that downtime on top of being in a new city and not really having any friends and not really knowing your teammates all that well, all of these are contributing factors to decision-making that probably led to this event. But yeah, it's a really good point, Steve.
I'm curious kind of if you can walk us through how Kimebridge works with your different partners. Because as I mentioned off the top of the interview, you work alongside a professional sports organization like NASCAR, but you're also working with sportsbook operators and then working with a company like US Integrity. Like, what are the services that you're providing those different stakeholders?
At the core, the common service across all of it is access to a clinical network that is growing in size pretty deep and is outfitted with a lot of clinical psychologists, psychiatrists, clinical social workers, all that are trained to treat not just the athlete, but also the gambling behavior coming from the athlete as well. And that is important because there's just not a lot of them out there organized in a way where they're easy to access. So a lot of the relationships at the core of it are all about giving access to the right people at the right time to the right resources when they need it. But there's a lot of additional work that goes into some of these particular relationships. So particularly with operators, it's analyzing a lot of data in the background and helping them paint a picture and understand what's going on with the treatment population in a way that makes it clear to them that there is a communication channel that they can deploy that is going to start making people think earlier about some of the things they may be experiencing while they're gambling, things such as insomnia. Insomnia is a really, really, really very high on the list of common complaints on folks who come in with a gambling issue. They don't sleep. They're up all the time, right? And so this is a telltale sign. And so some education around insomnia and insomnia being an early warning sign is information worth passing along. Also irritability, anger, right? There's a lot of anger issues. And so working with operators to try to find ways to communicate information out to the general public and to the audience that they serve and to them themselves that say, look, these are the common attributes that you see in the background. These are the things that we deal with. This is how this is going to appear in your data set. And this is some light level interventions that can get the ball start or get the ball rolling in communications. Right. So there's that approach with the sports leagues and teams. A lot of it is doing workshops. So giving them the opportunity to talk and ask questions is extremely important. And one of the things that we've recognized pretty much straight away is the transition periods. So being traded, getting ready to retire, coming into the league, like all of these are periods where, again, the athletes that they're most vulnerable because they're going through a period of time where they're not 100% confident in their surroundings and unfamiliar with their environment. Right. And so doing a lot of work around heightened awareness on transitions being extremely vulnerable times and then going deeper to provide services for any of the family members related to the players or the staff or the admin, including the players, staff and admin that might have additional questions about how some of this stuff is impacting mental health and some family members doing things that they are suspicious of, this type of stuff, right? So we really act as like a pathway and a gateway to have a conversation with a mental health provider who understands both the athlete mindset and the gambler's mindset, which is sort of a unique set of skills for counselors these days. And the interesting thing is our clinical population just keeps getting more and more exposure to it. So over a long enough period of time, we're going to have a really, really, really big network of care providers that understand both of these things, which is neat.
It does feel, you know, if you go back, we go back to the Shane Pinto suspension by the NHL at the start of the season, the 41 game suspension for the Ottawa Senators forward. And we see what's happened at the NFL with a rash of, you know, firings or suspensions for violating the NFL's gambling policy, that maybe the leagues have taken education a little bit for granted. And which on one hand seems a bit surprising that athletes wouldn't recognize the fact that you probably shouldn't be betting on your own league. I guess on the other hand, if given the prevalence of sports betting, especially now in a regulated world and a world of where it's so easy to bet on sports with your mobile device, that there does need to be more education. Is that something that you and the people you work with have found?
Yeah, like 100%. We find interesting little routes to education that is sort of outside of the norm of what you see on generalized education around this subject. Because a lot of times, like when you do some root cause analysis work, so to speak, with the client, like they went into, you know, their gambling behavior didn't just appear overnight. It was like a long sort of sustained exposure to something that sort of got them into this pattern, right? And a lot of what we are now focusing on is some upfront sort of readiness assessment education or intelligence briefings, if you will, for athletes, which is more an explanation of what's going on in the environment that you're walking into, not just like the rules and the regulations on what you've got to, you know, abide by in order to keep your contracts and things like that. not just warnings around what suspensions or bans you're going to get, not just lived experience on, hey, this is a gambling problem, this is terrible, it's going to ruin you and wreck you if you let it get out of control, but more around like, what's going on with your fan base? What's going on in your locker room, right? Like, what are the numbers around you of people who are probably irritated, agitated, upset, dealing with insomnia because of something they placed a bet on and it got out of control, and that now they need you to win based off of how the sports book is telling them that you need to win in order to win your bet? And then how does that then translate into, you know, the kind of harassment that you get online post-game or pre-game trying to influence the outcome? What kind of susceptibility does that have on you to being vulnerable to being influenced by match fixing, things like this, right? So we use this a lot with military training, which is like a readiness assessment for unit readiness, and try to explain like the one person's actions is going to corrode the whole, right? Like if you've got something that's out of sync, it's going to make the dynamics within the team not as cohesive as it can be potentially, right? So education is like the cornerstone of making sure that I think folks who come into the arena, so to speak, have the right kind of knowledge to arm themselves with, knowing that, look, these are the types of things that are out there. These are the types of things that are going to potentially try to influence me. Yes, it's important to know the rules, 100,000%. It's important to know what is going to basically prolong your career, right? But it is also extremely vital to understand your surroundings and understand the environment and understand that sports betting isn't just changing the way you play the game, right? But it's also changing the way that everybody experiences the game. And you kind of need to understand that the environment is continuously evolving, if that makes sense, right? Without education, you know, these guys and gals are all walking into an arena without really being warned and armed with the right kind of skills to cope with what's being thrown at them. And I think that's the thing. Like, that's the thing we're seeing on the harassment side of the equation too, right? Is you just get bombardment of bettors who lost a bet, lost a parlay, or are trying to influence the outcome of the game one way, shape, or form, which are getting on social media and harassing people, finding the athletes after the game, trying to find out where the athletes are before the game, these types of things. I think, like, at the professional level, you know, those guys have a little bit more resources available to them to help deal with these situations. At the collegiate level, it's hard. They're very young. Their brains aren't 100% developed yet. And they're dealing with situations where they have more pressure on them in a bigger arena than they've ever had before. So I think it's really, really vital to get to the student athletes at the collegiate level and the high school level and get them the right kind of education early on this.
I was going to say that education piece feels, Daniel, like it's a shared responsibility. I mean, I think it starts with parents, and it extends to agents or advisors and with colleges. You know, I think they're obviously, we know that athletes at college sports programs go through media training. And I think obviously gambling education is going to become an important piece of that puzzle. And I think that's become a big piece of U.S. Integrity's business. But it feels to me like that education is certainly a shared responsibility.
Yeah, I agree 100%, all the way across the board.
Hey, Daniel, last question. The gambling industry itself, the regulated industry, is taking a lot of flack right now when it comes to responsible gambling. And I think there's an element of society out there that feels that operators just pay lip service to responsible gambling and that there's not nearly enough done. I mean, you work very closely with the biggest players in the sports booking and gaming industry. Like, what do you say when you hear that criticism?
There's a lot that goes on the consumer protection side of the equation that is white space, because we're all trying to figure out how to respond and deal and construct and be constructive and put the right kind of architecture in place to understand how to have the right kind of impact on the problem. And I think what I find with the three groups that we work with is they're all interested and curious in pushing the envelope on trying to figure out what are the best approaches. And they really like to encourage thinking outside of the box on this, right? Like a lot of the RG education that's out there is old. A lot of it's outdated. A lot of it, especially US information, is sort of rooted in terrestrial brick and mortar casinos being the only way to get access to gambling. And a lot of it hasn't yet caught up to online. And I think there was, from what I saw and what I continue to see, but less of now, 4 years ago when we sort of stepped into this, online was becoming available. And all of the treatment providers historically who were in the space had no experience with it. And their entire approach was to talk to somebody and work on care plans and care journeys for people based off of the experience that they had on the bricks and mortar side of the equation. The online side of the equation is totally different, right? And so thinking about how education is framed and how policy is created and really how RG strategy is deployed and thought through and innovations in the space really sort of require thinking about what this hybrid environment is, where you've got plenty of access to bricks and mortar casino, but now you've got access in your pocket 24/7. And I think, like, you know, I sort of grew up with my gambling education and responsible gambling, learning from what the UK had gone through for like the last 15 years. And I could see all of it playing out in a way when the States started coming online, where it just looked like, you know, there's a train wreck coming. I'm not 100% sure what it's going to look like, but man, does it look awfully similar to what we've experienced over in the UK. But now, like, I'm sort of like, well, everybody is just really, really eager and really desperate to try to get to some really good solutions quickly. And so I see a lot more innovation going on over in the US market than I ever saw globally anywhere else. Because I think there's a race to use innovation to put prevention, education, and treatment tools out there into the general public really as fast as possible. But you know, you got your early adopters and you got your slow adopters, and that's just sort of the nature of industry, not necessarily just for casino, but you know, you're going to go through wave after wave of regulation here that I think will influence the way that we think about RG and adopt RG. And we'll have some groups that are racing out in front and trying to influence and really doing a good job of putting the right types of things in place, or what we think are the right times of thing through the right types of things to learn from, to adjust. And then you're going to have folks that are just waiting, and they're just going to keep waiting until somebody steps in and tells them what they got to do. You know, so I see it as a different environment compared to what I experienced over in Europe. But I see it as a very new environment and a very eager environment to get to some sustainability and some solutions quickly. Does that help?
It helps, helps a ton. Just sorry, Daniel, one more question, just off that. And here in Ontario with the regulated industry, there's been, you know, concern or some frustration that there hasn't been enough data and research done quickly enough, and that you know, there's still a bit of blindness when it comes to how to react to problem gambling and exercising that innovation that you talked about. Have you seen, is it the same story in the U.S. where, you know, where we have about 38 U.S. states now with legal sports betting, six or seven states with legal iGaming? Is there still a lack of data out there?
It's a great question. The answer comes in different shapes and forms depending on what lens you're trying to look through. So I believe, with what I've seen and had access to, that if you look at a lot of the data that's collected through anti-money laundering software, for example, and KYC software, you can see predictable patterns of what might look like a gambling problem. Right. But on the other side of the equation, the healthcare side, which is the side that we're desperately trying to work on and fix, there is an extreme lack of data. And it's because historically, this has been a very quiet, very silent, very hidden disease. It is a diagnosable disease, right? But historically, clinicians across the countries have not really had a lot of education on what this is, and it's not screened for. And when you present in an emergency room, it's very rarely asked if your gambling had anything to do with the reason why you're in here. And even in psych evaluations, a lot of psych evaluations out there don't even ask questions about gambling. So it's missed, right? So for a disease that's been historically missed, right, there is shockingly little data to work off of to know if there is a connection between the anti-money laundering and KYC data and actual healthcare diagnoses, right? And so I think as we continue down this path, this is going to be a bridge that we close the gap on, right? Which I think will be very, very interesting, because I think that's the biggest missing piece, is understanding what the connection is between what we see in terms of patterns, right? And I think like a really good way to think about this is now risk scoring on your player population, if you're the operator, is becoming an incredibly important metric to host, right? So, you know, in the background, theoretically, you know, there's a risk scoring system and you're monitoring all of the player activity and it's putting you into a bucket and it's saying, you know, you're a risky player between one and, let's say, theoretically five, right? And what are the common attributes of a person who moves between two and three? What are the common attributes of a person who moves between three and four? How do we communicate with those people? What do we say, right? And I think that the real sort of like stall on the tracks with moving forward with a lot of this is like, just because we see those behavior patterns and they're indicative doesn't mean we know what the heck we're supposed to be doing right then and there, which makes everybody nervous, right? So it's like, if you can see, like, based off of a criteria, this person is heading down, you know, from a two to a three, but you don't really have any answers on what you're supposed to do with that, like, that's the other side of the equation that now needs to be thought through and sorted out of, okay, well, if we see these things happening, what sort of database does this information go into? How do we learn from this? How do we cross-correlate this with what goes on in the mental health world? How do we talk to some of these folks and find out what's going on with them in the mental health world and see what the connection is, right? I think once you got that kind of firmed up and it's not as loosely correlated as it is now, I think you get to a more interesting environment where you get this sort of fluid, seamless communication that goes on that is way more oriented around consumer protection early and often. And then I think you get to much better RG tools. I think you just get to much richer conversations. I think it just becomes a much more sustainable environment, right? But I think there's a long way to go for that. And I think, you know, I've been lucky so far with this, is we've got some big groups that are willing to, you know, break some eggs to make an omelet and get moving on this space and try to be out front with all of it. And I think we'll set the tone for what comes next. And I think the only way you do that, honestly, is with the legal market being legal, right? Because if I was still doing all of this in a black market situation, none of this would get done, right? So I think for all the things that RG is and all the things that RG isn't, I think we have to recognize that the only way we actually get to some decent consumer protections is through a legal market, right? Like, and we have to understand that there is a journey here and that we are all learning as we go, because this is all new for most of us. Like, this is pretty new environment to be learning from. So that's, I think, you know, my sort of standard response in situations like that is like, if you don't take the good with the bad and the bad with the good, you're not going to learn and you're not going to end up achieving something that could be way more sustainable down the line, which is why I kind of bring this full circle. The more data that we have on the healthcare side of the equation, the better we can make the environment.
That's a terrific insight. Daniel Umfleet is the founder and chief executive officer of Kindbridge Behavioral Health. Daniel, thanks so much for joining us on the Gaming News Canada show, and we look forward to I'd love to have you back on at some point and discuss this topic, because as you say, we're still very early days here, and that there's feels like a fast moving train.
Absolutely. Appreciate your time, Steve. Thank you very much for inviting me on.
That's it for this edition of the Gaming News Canada show. As always, you can find this podcast at gamingnewscanada.ca and on the various podcast platforms. If you'd like to be a sponsor or advertiser of the Gaming News Canada show, please drop me an email, steve@gamingnewscanada.ca. Thanks again to Doug Smith from the Toronto Star, Mike Mazzeo from Legal Sports Report, and Daniel Umfleet from Kindbridge Behavioral Health. And we will see everybody again soon.
Thank you for listening to the Gaming News Canada show. Sign up for our newsletter at gamingnewscanada.ca. Follow Steve McAllister on LinkedIn. Message Steve if you're interested in being a sponsor or featured guest.